Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Erin Wagermiller. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, April 3rd, 2018.
Our concern is that it is likely a compound that is commonly found in rat poison that has been added to the spice.
The Indiana State Department of Health warns a batch of synthetic marijuana, also referred to as spice, could cause severe health complications to customers in Indiana. As WFHB's Jonah Chester reports, rat poison is being mixed with the legal drug. We'll hear from Chester later in the program on today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Charlotte Zitlow talks about her push to save the Monroe County Courthouse in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
A 9-member team from the Urban Land Institute will tour the grounds of IU Health Bloomington Hospital next week. The consultants are expected to recommend to the city of Bloomington what to do with the land. IU Health Bloomington Hospital is moving to the bypass on Bloomington's northeast side in 2020. The city hired the Urban Land Institute to help determine how to best develop the 24-acre site where the hospital is now. In January, the city of Bloomington announced they would buy the current hospital site from IU Health for $6.5 million. According to its website, the Urban Land Institute is a global real estate organization which provides consultations in the responsible use of land. The review of IU Health's property by the Urban Land Institute is expected to cost $135,000. Bloomington Deputy Mayor Mick Renison says the city is looking for recommendations for the future development of the 24-acre downtown site.
They're coming here to give us some indication of what they think would be the right use of the property for our community. So there's not necessarily a cookie-cutter approach that in every city where there's an abandoned hospital, do you do the same thing? It's unique to the environment, the city's resources, and they'll tell us a little bit about what they think the proper zoning should be for future use.
During their visit, the Urban Land Institute consultants are expected to interview up to 100 people identified by the city as community stakeholders, people with a personal, financial, or public interest in the site's future use. Urban Land Institute Director of Advisory Services, Paul Angelone, says the team will conduct a thorough review of all aspects of possible reuse for the IU Health site, including the parking garage, existing infrastructure, and the correct zoning for redevelopment of the site.
We'll listen and hear from residents, business officials, city officials, and others about what they think should happen, and then using all the information, we'll take that and then come up with recommendations on Wednesday and Thursday.
The panel will present their recommendations and ideas to the city on April 13th. A comprehensive report will be delivered to the city sometime in June. That report is expected to address redevelopment financing, implementation, design ideas, and community feedback. The city expects to take the ownership of the current hospital property after IU Health completely moves the hospital to the new location in 2020. The city will take ownership of the downtown site in 2021.
The city of Bloomington will install a traffic light at the intersection of Rockport and Tap Road this summer. According to traffic engineer Andrew Seabor, the city will bear only a small percentage of the project costs.
We have a significant amount of federal funding going towards this project. 80% of the eligible project costs will be federally funded. CBU is also contributing a significant portion as it relates to a water main extension. So that's something we are not covering. It's not something that the RDC or the federal funding would be contributing towards. But that's for about $130,000.
Seabor spoke in yesterday's meeting of the Bloomington Redevelopment Commission. The commission approved using TIF funds for the city's portion of the project, about $480,000. The intersection will include turn lanes, a sidewalk, and a multi-use path. A traffic signal will replace the existing four-way stop. CBOR says construction should start this June and will wrap up sometime later this year.
The commission went on to approve a plat plan presented by CBOR for the south end of the city's trades district.
So this is the southern half of the trades district. So it's the area bounded by Rogers Street, the future trade street, which is an east-west street between 10th and 11th, the alley just west of Morton Street and 10th Street. So it's that area.
Two of the parcels are slightly less than 1 acre each. Commission member Eric Sandweiss asked whether these two parcels could be subdivided in the future.
So I'll just say I understand that the urge to, particularly from the standpoint of attracting developers, of keeping large undivided lots. At the same time, I would also advise that we don't want this to become just another office or industrial park in the middle of town. It wasn't the idea behind it in the first place, and I hope that we can encourage or at least not discourage the possibility of kind of a finer-grained urban infrastructure.
Controller Jeff Underwood said, the current plan is to locate smaller lots in the northern part of the trades district. Underwood says the city could break up the larger parcels in the trade district. CBOR says that fits with Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton's push to develop the trades district and tech park downtown as soon as possible.
What we're looking at is possibly one or two locations that will have smaller, more narrow but longer lots that will allow smaller businesses to develop so that we can break it up from having like maybe three large or four large ones that give people an opportunity that couldn't necessarily afford to develop a larger tract or afford to, they want ownership rather than rent, so we'll give them an opportunity to purchase a smaller lot and develop that inside the trades district. So we're looking at a couple of locations right now where we would have three to six lots, maybe nine total.
Again, outside of the southern half.
Outside the southern half on the northern side, yeah.
And just to add maybe a little bit, the project as a whole is adding two new streets that don't exist. Mm-hmm. This plat is also adding a new north-south alley to help. Almost it requires smaller developments, and I know just being part of the Planning Commission as well that everything you've relayed is something that the administration and city wants to push for.
CBOR adds that the two new streets through the district will include parking and be pedestrian-friendly with large tree plots. The Southern Trades District plat plan will also go before the Bloomington Plan Commission on Monday for final approval. A plat plan for the north end is still being developed.
Bloomington Utilities Director Vic Kelson says his department is hearing concerns from the public about a recent fee increase for testing swimming pool water. Speaking in yesterday's Utilities Service Board meeting, Kelson said the fee now reflects the actual cost of the service. He said under the previous rate, property owners without pools were subsidizing the testing cost.
The reason that charge went up so much is that we are charging what it costs to provide the service. Over time, we had not changed the price for pool testing for many years, and for a number of years, the remaining ratepayers have been subsidizing pool testing for anyone who has swimming pools. So, unfortunately, that's led to a situation where a number of our customers are receiving a large increase in that fee that they likely hadn't anticipated.
The Bloomington City Council approved raising the pool testing fee last November, along with several other non-recurring fees. Kelson said the Monroe County Health Department requires public properties like hotels, country clubs, and apartment complexes to test their pools bi-weekly for bacteria. The fee for the two required tests previously cost around $10 each. Now one test is $37 and the other is $22.
And it can be substantial if you have several facilities with several pools, but I just wanted to make sure that the board and that the public understands that we are only trying to recover the charge, the cost of doing that operation for our customers, and we understand that this was a big jump, but it hadn't been reviewed in 15 or 16 years, so that's what led to it.
Kelson said even the city itself is paying the new fee to test its own pools. He He said the financial analysis that led to the fee increase is available to the public upon request.
Governor Eric Holcomb is expected to cut the ribbon on a Women's Department of Corrections coding class on Thursday. Governor Holcomb will officially kick off the Last Mile program at the Indiana Women's Prison. That program purportedly teaches Hoosier inmates how to code to help them secure jobs after they are released from incarceration. Indiana is the second state to adopt the coding program after California. The program costs somewhere around $200,000, with each inmate requiring about $5,000 additional dollars per year. The state has set up one classroom with a 24 to 30 person capacity. In a press release, Holcomb says he hopes the program will help inmates reintegrate into the labor market after release. He's pledged to allow for at least 1,000 inmates to earn coding certificates and credentials by 2020. The female prisoners' coding program is also expected to help reduce recidivism. In California, the program has zero instances of a graduate going back to prison. The Last Mile program is expected to teach courses in HTML, JavaScript, CSS, and Python. Holcomb says the state hopes to expand the course to include web and logo design, data visualization, and user interfacing. In order to qualify for the Last Mile program, inmates must have a clean record for 2 years inside prison. If a participant commits an infraction, they're removed from the program. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Erin Wager-Miller. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar-powered generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
The Indiana State Department of Health is warning residents that a chemical commonly found in rat poison is also being found in batches of synthetic marijuana, or spice, around the state. As WFHB's Jonah Chester reports, the chemical is an anticoagulant, and health experts are worried about the physical consequences of someone smoking the substance.
The Indiana State Department of Health is warning Indiana residents about the dangers of synthetic marijuana after cases of severe bleeding across the state were linked to the drug. Last month, 25 Indianapolis residents overdosed on artificial marijuana in just 2 days in one Indianapolis neighborhood. Last week, 4 Indianapolis residents overdosed on the drug at a prison inmate re-entry facility, according to RTV6. In a press release, the ISDH warned that the drug, which also goes under the name spice, has the potential to cause severe and even life-threatening side effects.
These are chemicals that are synthesized in a laboratory that are meant to mimic some of the same effects that you get from the active ingredients found in the marijuana plant.
This is Dr. Daniel Rasiniak, medical director of the Indiana Poison Control Center.
What we're dealing with right now is an emerging outbreak or epidemic of people who are smoking synthetic marijuana and presenting to hospitals with problems related to bleeding.
The cause of the internal bleeding, according to Dr. Rasiniak, is a chemical that is commonly used in pest control products that is also found in several varieties of spice.
We do not think at this point that it is related to the compounds that you smoke in spice, but rather our concern is that it is likely a compound that is commonly found in rat poison that has been added to the spice. There's a large number of different chemicals that have been synthesized that are shown to work in the brain at the same areas or same receptors that THC does.
The chemical is not present in all spice products, according to Dr. Rasiniak. The ISDH is still waiting for confirmation from the Centers for Disease Control on which specific artificial marijuana product contains the poisonous chemical.
Compounds work. They're sometimes called long-acting anticoagulants or superwarfarins. They work that by inhibiting proteins that your liver normally makes that allows your blood to clot. So normally, if you injure yourself, you activate or you release some proteins from your liver that will allow that blood to clot so you don't bleed to death. Well, you can inhibit that system with certain compounds. The drug Coumadin or warfarin is a drug that lots of people are placed on every year who have clotting disorders, people who clot too easily and may develop a blood clot in their leg or a blood clot in their lung or the blood clot in their heart. And so we will often put patients on these Coumadin or warfarin compounds to help prevent their blood from clotting so much. What we're dealing with, and we think we're dealing with here, is what we call long-acting or super warfarin. They work the same way that Coumadin does in your body, but they are more potent and they last much, much longer. If you take a dose of Coumadin, it may only decrease your clotting for a day or so. These compounds decrease your clotting for months, and even in some patients, they've been reported up to years.
According to Dr. Raciniak, the most dangerous part of contaminated spice is that the user may not be aware of the potentially lethal side effects until it is too late.
The concern is we don't know how many patients are walking around who are at risk if they fall, if they sneeze really hard, if they're in a car accident, of having a severe bleeding problem, or even worse, bleeding to death.
The issue of uncontrolled blood loss is just one of the many negative side effects that spice can cause. There are many different chemical compounds that are labeled and then sold as artificial marijuana. Each of these compounds can have its own unique set of side effects.
To date, there's been over 170 different chemicals that have been identified that have been synthesized and sold or used as synthetic marijuana. And so because of that, we can see a variety of different presentations after somebody uses it. We can see somebody get sleepy and kind of unresponsive, and these have sometimes been called zombie syndrome. There was an outbreak in Brooklyn. There was a recent outbreak in Indianapolis where people describe that the folks, after they smoke it, as to looking like zombies, which is just another way of saying they kind of come unresponsive and really slow in their movements. You can see people become severely agitated and confused and aggressive and have really high heart rates and really high blood pressures. You can see patients develop kidney failure and kidney damage. That's been reported with certain strains of spice or K2. So you can get a variety of different presentations, and it is likely that they're all different because there are so many different chemicals, and people almost never know exactly which chemical they're getting when they smoke or use one of these products.
Dr. Raciniak advises people who smoke spice to be wary of bruises or wounds. If they have a bleeding disorder caused by the drug, even a small wound could result in serious consequences.
People who are smoking spice, they should watch for any signs of bruising or bleeding that they have. And certainly there's some concern if they think any of the products that they're using have come from Chicago or the Chicago area, then they should go and be tested for a bleeding disorder. At least until we figure out what products are causing this, we need to be careful and probably err on the side of having patients go to the hospital and be tested for excessive bleeding if they are spice smokers, particularly if they're having any problems where they notice nosebleeds or bruising of the skin or their gums bleeding or anything like that. I mean, in general, all of these drugs that you're purchasing on the internet or through local dealers, there is no ability to ever be sure of what you're getting. The risks are becoming greater over time. We're seeing far more complications related to the synthetic marijuanas as well as the synthetic opioids that are being sold as heroin, as well as the synthetic cathinones that are being sold as methamphetamine and stimulants. So it is a really difficult problem that we're dealing with, but I think people need to get help and try to get the help that they need to treat their addictions, because it's becoming incredibly dangerous to buy or use any of these substances.
Anyone who has questions about spice usage or if they've encountered complications from the drug can contact the Indiana Poison Control Center at 1-800-222-1222. If you are experiencing a spice-related overdose, Dr. Raciniak recommends going to the nearest emergency medical center or dialing 911. Reporting for WFHB, I'm Jonah Chester.
been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is Charlotte Zitlow, and this is my Monroe County story. Actually, I have a lot of them, but a big one is the one about the courthouse. The courthouse stands beautifully in the middle of town right now, and that is a result of the work of many, many, many people in the early 80s. When the courthouse was in terrible condition, when it was overflowing, when Judge Kellams had his office in a bathroom and Judge Dixon had the ceiling fall on his head and Judge Baker thought that it was inappropriate to have raw sewage in the basement of the courthouse and Judge Todd could only get to his office by going through the courtroom or coming in through the window. So it was really full and overflowing with boxes and wires. The second and third floor were all filled in. And I'm a brand new county commissioner and everybody else is tired of dealing with it. And they say, Charlotte, take care of it. Save the courthouse. And I found out that many, many of the major people in the community really thought that courthouse should be torn down. It's old and it's messy and it's dirty and it's a fire trap. Just tear it down and build up a new office building. That wasn't very appealing. And that there were a whole bunch of other people who thought, you tear that courthouse down and we'll just kill you. So I had to come to some arrangement that would help save the courthouse. And by really hard work, working with people who totally disagreed about it. Scott Schurz, who was the publisher of the newspaper, was one of the ones who really thought it should be torn down. And Rick Zabriskie, the president of the Bloomington Restorations Corporation, was one of the ones who said, you know, you tear it down, we'll kill you. So I thought, okay, we're working with both of them. And Lester DeCoker, who said, I don't care what you do as long as it doesn't cost any money. And Judge Dixon, who said, I don't care what you do, as long as you get people out of the jail, which is a terrible, awful fire trap, which it was. And there were people with offices and papers all over around the square. And we had all these different people working together, a 9-member steering committee for about 2.5 years, at which point we finally said, oh, we're exhausted. We've got to figure something out. We looked at all sorts of alternatives of what people had done in other counties and other places in the state, and found that many of them were not very successful. Madison had torn down its courthouse, and its new courthouse was losing its facing into the street and was not well accepted by the community. That was not an alternative. And we went through one alternative after another and finally hired an architect, Larry Burke, who came back with 5 options, as we suggested. And one of them was what we ended up doing, which was saving the courthouse and building the Justice Building and putting all of the land use and property management offices in the courthouse and the criminal justice system and the jail and the sheriff in the new Justice Center, which satisfied both needs. And so we did save the courthouse, but it wasn't easy. Once we came up with that suggestion, we had a big meeting with Frank McCloskey and 150 community leaders and said, what do you think? And they said, well, that's the idea that we think we should follow. And we did follow that. There were a lot of little nooks and crannies that we had to fall in before we actually got to the actual construction, but we made it. We made it. We didn't have to carry Judge Dixon on a flatbed truck in his bench, as I thought we would have to, because he didn't believe we could do it. But we did it. We had a campaign, we had banners, we had bumper stickers, we had cans at every restaurant that collected money. And we wrote to every single parcel owner in the county, told them that they would be saving money if they would pay cash instead of us entering into a bond issue. We raised $11,000 in cash with that mailing. And we finally got the people who had always remonstrated in the past to sort of give up and say, okay, we're going to go along with this time. And we saved the courthouse, and it's beautiful. And people were really happy when they walked in after it was open again and looked all the way up to the dome, which had been totally covered in. They were amazed and remembered what a beautiful building it was and that it still is.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal. Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
Today's headlines were written by Chuhan G. and Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Jonah Chester.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welsh with help from Joyce Poling. Our engineer is Wes Martin. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumstein, Scott Schmadeke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Aaron Wagermiller.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@WFHB.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at WFHB.org and catch live broadcasts of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.